I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we are joined by our guest, Tevi Troy. He is joining us again, actually. We had such a great conversation with him last time, talking about his wonderful book, Shall We Wake the President? Today, we're going to be talking about another topic in presidential history, one that I think is going to shed some really interesting light on the presidency, on the economy, and on the relationship between the two. For those who don't know Tevi, he is, of course, a presidential historian and was formerly the U.S. Department Secretary of Health and Human Services, involved there. And, of course, I think now, are you senior fellow at the Reagan Institute?
I am, as of this week, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, welcome to your new position. Congratulations on that. This book is your new book, which I want to highly recommend to all of our listeners, is called The Power and the Money, The Epic Clashes Between Commanders-in-Chief and Titans of Industry. Boy, what an interesting theme for a book. And we talked, you mentioned this book last time when we talked, and I had a chance to dip into it, and it is a page-turner. It's really an interesting story that unfolds about the clash, as the subtitle says, but also the kind of reciprocal need that CEOs and commanders-in-chief have for each other. Maybe I should start with this question, Tevi. When did we first start to see clashes between presidents and at what you call titans of industry?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I really did enjoy our last conversation, Jeff, and I remember that I kind of teased this idea of the power of the money and suggested that you might want to have me on when that comes out. I had no idea how timely it would be in terms of the CEO involvement in a second Trump term and Elon Musk heading a Department of Government Efficiency. So the timing is really fortuitous. The clashes really begin at the beginning of the 20th century. The fact is, and I lay this out in The Power of the Money, there was very little mechanisms for government if they wanted to do anything to business before the 20th century begins. So Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, builds his empire and a monopoly with very little ability of government to rein in what he was doing. But then you start to have the development of the Sherman Antitrust Act, and you have politicians like Theodore Roosevelt who go after the trusts and go after big business. And the combination of having executive interest and executive direction against these companies, plus legislative efforts to rein them in, led to a situation in the early 20th century where you start to have these clashes develop. And that's really where the book, I think, gets going.
And if you were to say, let's mark the beginning of these clashes, what's the first real epic clash, or at least the first epic clash that makes its way into the newspapers for the public to hear about and know about?
Well, I'd have to talk about J.P. Morgan in 1895. There's a financial crisis, and he goes down to Washington, and he tells Grover Cleveland, who's in the news again these days because he's similar to Trump in that he ran, lost, and then ran again and won, so you know, serving two non-consecutive terms, that he has an idea for how to solve the financial crisis. Grover Cleveland doesn't want to meet with him. And J.P. Morgan basically says, I'm here, I'm in a hotel, and I'm staying until you see me. And then he does see him, and Grover Cleveland is, in the end, glad he saw him because Morgan helps fix the U.S. economy, although at some political cost to Grover Cleveland. So that was the first one. But I think the really big one is between Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and John D. Rockefeller. It's interesting that it happens after Rockefeller's technically retired from heading his company, but he's still a convenient villain. And Roosevelt uses him as someone who he's targeting. He's going after him specifically. There are times where there are things that Standard Oil does that, in terms of lobbying, that Rockefeller had nothing to do with, but Roosevelt sees it as convenient to blame Rockefeller for doing it. And he has late night meetings in the White House where he's specifically targeting Rockefeller and talking about how to go after his company. So I think that's really the first big epic clash in the book. And really, as you said, a riveting read.
And of course, as you lay out in the book, as we move in through the early 20th century, we get into the 1920s. And there it looks like, for example, during the Coolidge presidency, that there is a kind of, if symbiotic might be too strong a word, but a kind of positive relationship between President Calvin Coolidge and at least some titans of industry, even perhaps in his cabinet. What's the relationship in the 20s before setting the stage, of course, for the Great Depression in the 30s?
Well, I think what I try to get at in The Power of the Money is that there are both negative aspects and positive aspects to dealing with companies and CEOs. The negative side we've already talked about, they have monopolistic practices or sharp elbows, or they do things that government wants to rein in. The positive side is they can bring a lot of benefits. They can talk up the economy. They can be celebrities like Elon Musk is. His celebrity was at least as valuable to Trump as the celebrity of, let's say, Taylor Swift was to Kamala Harris. So they're celebrities. There's kind of a reflected glory of dealing with these big iconic American figures. They can bring in money to the campaign. So there's a lot of benefits. And I think Coolidge, and to some extent Harding before him, they see the benefit of dealing with CEOs, of being photographed with them. There's this group called the Vagabonds, and Henry Ford was one of them. They traveled the country and they would do these vacations, and they had a Ford cameraman go with them. And both Harding and Coolidge come to the Vagabond vacation sites and hang out with them. And it's seen as a benefit to all. The president benefits from being seen with these titans of industry, and the industry people get some benefit, political benefit, from being near the president.
Of course, that relationship, as you talk about, the relationship changes or is more complicated than when we get to the late 20s, the early 30s, the Great Depression, and the New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt is declared by some to be a traitor to his class, directly targets captains of industry. But on the other hand, wants to seem to try to work with them in certain ways. Talk about the complicated relationship that FDR has with titans of industry.
Yeah, FDR obviously takes office during the Great Depression. So business has taken a reputational hit, and he's happy to go after them and criticize them. He even has a designated cabinet member, Harold Ickes, who is the father of the Harold Ickes that was a fixer for Bill Clinton. So Ickes is the one who would denounce the CEOs and titans of industry on behalf of Roosevelt and his political operation. He also has this thing called the Blue Eagle from the NRA, the National Recovery Administration. And the companies that take on whatever government wanted them to do and proudly showed the Blue Eagle, those are companies that are seen to be in good odor with the government. I happen to think it has a slight whiff of fascism, and I'm not the only one who has said that. So it's not just me, you know, lightly using the F word, because I am very careful of using that word inappropriately, as it has been used in our political rhetoric in recent years. But that kind of government saying we favor these industries and not those industries, that really is the whiff of fascism. And so Henry Ford doesn't like this stuff at all. And Roosevelt's designated person on these issues goes out to see Ford and tells him, oh, well, you know, we'd really like you to get the Blue Eagle. And Ford says, I don't want to have that darn buzzard on my businesses. Yeah, there really are some interesting clashes between Ford and the Roosevelt administration. And Ford really couldn't stand Roosevelt, told anti-Roosevelt jokes. And by the way, if you get The Power of the Money, there's a great appendix that has some of the funniest jokes told by and about CEOs. So it's worth the price of admission right there. But then Ford does turn around a little bit after World War II begins, because everybody steps up, even the people who were isolationists before, and steps up to support the American war effort against the Nazis. And Ford builds the biggest armaments plant in America and in the world at Willow Run to support the war effort. And Roosevelt even goes out to visit Ford there. They have a bit of an uncomfortable car ride together, but the fact of the matter is they are cooperating on this important thing of getting the needed armaments to the boys who are fighting the war abroad.
When you see these kind of clashes, say, between a Henry Ford and an FDR, are the clashes caused by personality differences, by ideological differences, by class differences? What do you see?
I would say yes to all when it came to Henry Ford. I mean, Roosevelt, as we said, was a patrician, and Ford was kind of more of a bootstraps kind of guy. Ford just didn't like Roosevelt, period. He just didn't like his approach to things. And then ideologically, there was a vast divide. So that's not always, but that's not always the case. I would say these days, CEOs and presidents tend to be from the same classes, the upper classes. And that's actually one of the reasons why I think we see CEOs tending to be a little more favorable to the Democrats these days than the policies might suggest, because it used to be Republicans were businessmen, businessmen were Republicans. But in recent years, you're seeing a lot more criticism of companies from both parties, from both Democrats and Republicans. And a lot of these CEOs say, well, if the Democrats are going to criticize me and the Republicans are going to criticize me, I might as well hang out with the people whose kids go to my kids' school. And increasingly, those are kind of blue state bubble elite college type people. And so these days, there is that personality aspect of it, or the class aspect of it, that leads to big businesses being a little more favorable to Democrats than maybe the policies would warrant.
Did you see that same kind? Now I'm thinking of the post-war era, from sort of, as you mentioned, there's a kind of coming together in industry during World War II, but then the war is over. And from 45 until maybe Reagan's time or so, I think a lot of people, at least in the popular imagination, think this is a time when industry and government, titans of industry and presidents, got along really well together, and sort of everybody worked together for the common good of America. Is that popular understanding true, or is it more complicated?
I mean, there's some truth to it. I don't think business was nearly as pilloried then as it is now. But you had clashes. I talk in the book about Lou Wasserman, who is a Hollywood agent, wants to buy a studio, and he gets into conflict with Robert F. Kennedy's Justice Department, which is what leads Wasserman to get more and more involved in Washington and befriends multiple presidents, including LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, and Ronald Reagan. You also have Lee Iacocca, who his first meeting in the Nixon White House is when he's trying to convince Nixon to overturn a Department of Transportation effort to impose Ralph Nader-like regulations on the auto industry. So, you know, government was still getting involved in stuff, and government can have a huge impact on these businesses. Negative policies or negative regulations can really harm companies, and they're very cognizant of it. Also, I wouldn't necessarily put a capstone to that era with Reagan, because Reagan was generally pretty friendly with corporations. That doesn't mean he did everything they wanted, but in general, Reagan wanted to have a pro-business attitude in his administration, and we saw a real economic boom in those years.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
One of the things that we know from American history, the continuing issue of things like tariffs, which start, you know, way back at the American founding all the way through the late 19th century, it's an important issue. The parties seem to switch positions and maybe have switched positions again on the issue of tariffs. And of course, tariffs affecting some business interests positively, some negatively. On particular issues, does that cause conflict between CEOs and presidents on things like tariffs, or is it a broader causes that create conflict?
Obviously, tariffs is an issue of conflict. And one of the things that's going on with tariffs is it used to be these were congressionally determined things. And now it's much more in the power of the executive branch to say, I'm going to target this business and not that business. That makes it more open to lobbying of the executive branch because these CEOs want to call the president to say, well, Mr. President, of course, I love the idea of tariffs on my competition, but don't do it on my company. And so, yeah, I think that that is part of it. And I think we're going to have a bit of a free-for-all if Trump really goes through with his ideas about putting forth tariffs on pretty much every product. And I think at the end of the day, he's not actually going to do it, but we'll see.
In contemporary times, you've already mentioned there's an interesting relationship. I mean, one of the thesis of the book is, you know, that there's a difference between a president and a titan of industry, that they're two different people. What if you have a president who is in a certain way a titan of industry? People have, you know, a very rich person who's been very successful in business, someone like a Donald Trump. In the contemporary age, do we still see the clash, or has government developed in such a way that, in fact, now there is a more involved and maybe symbiotic relationship, whether it's good or bad, between government and big industry?
Yeah, what I call it in The Power of the Money is more of an entangled relationship.
Explain that. That's a really interesting term.
Now, big business and big government are entangled in a way in that there's this massive regulatory state, and it affects everything companies do, who they can hire and what kind of products they can sell and what countries they can sell them in and how they can use their energy and what they can do with the polluted runoff from their products. And that means that if you're a company, you need to be incredibly cognizant of what government is doing. In fact, I recommend in the book, In the Power of the Money, that CEOs on their first day of the job need to get in touch with their Washington operatives and see what's going on in Washington. In fact, this was the advice that Bill Gates, who had a rough time with the Clinton Justice Department, he gives to Mark Zuckerberg when he meets a young and somewhat starry-eyed Mark Zuckerberg. He says, get an office there now. And there means Washington, D.C. So, yeah, these companies need to be very aware of what the government's doing. The entanglement, though, is that sometimes regulations and the regulatory state provide a benefit to the bigger companies, because as we know, complexity is a subsidy. And the big companies can afford to pay for the lawyers and the lobbyists and the compliance officials that allow them to deal with all the massive number of government regulations, whereas a young up-and-coming innovative company may not be able to do that. So in many ways, the regulatory state creates a barrier to entry to new companies. So while it may cost Apple or Google or Meta a lot of money to deal with the vast number of regulations that are out there, it's not a crippling amount of money, and they can still make huge profits even as they comply with whatever the regulatory state imposes on them. But their competitors may not be able to rise up and become competitors, or at least equivalent sized, as long as you have these massive number of regulations that limits their growth.
Is there, I think a lot of people are, particularly in recent days with the announcement of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, that's going to be apparently led by Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. I think some of our listeners would be really curious to know, is there any historical analogy for a character, a person, a personality like Elon Musk, who is a titan of industry, who has gotten close to a president and now seems to be taking over some of the policy portfolio of the next administration?
I think there are some historical analogies to Musk. They're not perfect, of course, but in some ways, Henry Ford was like Musk in that he remakes the automobile. He buys a platform to get his views out there. Unfortunately, it was an anti-Semitic newspaper called the Dearborn Independent. He thinks about running for office, runs for Senate unsuccessfully in 1918, is playing around with the idea of running for president in the 1920s, tries to convince Wilson not to get involved in World War I. Wilson only sees him because he's Henry Ford and a big deal. So there's some similarities there. Another similar person is Henry Luce, who's the founder of Time magazine, tries to beat Franklin Roosevelt in multiple elections and is unsuccessful. But in 1952, he goes all in for Dwight Eisenhower and provides certain staff members for Eisenhower, provides the support of Time magazine for Eisenhower. And this is interesting, provides the conceptualization of the Eisenhower foreign policy that he puts in Time magazine and ends up being part of the 1952 Republican platform. And then he's involved in the administration to the extent that sometimes they ask him for his advice and his wife becomes ambassador to Italy. So I think there's some analogies there, but I think Musk is at a different level.
is it inevitable when you get this kind of working relationship between a CEO and a president, both of whom are used to being in charge, both of whom are used to commanding and giving orders? Do you find it that even the closest friendships between these two inevitably end in conflict, or are there examples, historical examples of really successful partnerships?
Yeah, I don't think they necessarily end in conflict, especially if the CEO doesn't get involved in government. Once the CEO enters government, then he or she is under the thumb of the president, and a lot of these big name CEOs don't like. But on the other hand, the flip side is that presidents like these CEOs because they feel like they can understand each other. They both had massive operations and nobody really is their peer in those operations. Everybody is either gunning for them or needing something from them or both. And so there's what I call in the book, the loneliness of leadership. And I think CEOs and presidents can benefit from interacting with one another. And in fact, I tell a story of Lyndon Johnson's White House when Lou Wasserman comes out of Lyndon Johnson's room late at night around 2 o'clock in the morning once, and he runs into Mrs. Johnson and he apologizes to Mrs. Johnson for keeping the president up so late. And she says, "Oh no, Lou, you don't understand. He lives for this. He loved those late night conversations with Lou Wasserman because he was one of the few people that Johnson could view as a peer. And Johnson didn't necessarily view his subordinates as peer. And in fact, he was a pretty rough boss on all of his subordinates, even if they were cabinet officials or the vice president, Hubert Humphrey, whom he abused pretty badly. But Wasserman, he treated like a peer."
What about when CEOs join a cabinet? Tell us a little bit more about how the relationship develops if a CEO becomes part of the presidential administration.
So I think there's a bad history there. And you look at someone like someone like Jack Welch wisely said, "I'm not going to get involved." He knew 10 presidents, multiple presidents asked him to join cabinets, and he said no. But then you look at someone like Rex Tillerson. He was CEO of ExxonMobil, and he does join the Trump administration, is constantly at odds with Trump and Trump's aides, both at State Department and at the White House. And eventually he's fired by tweet that he discovers while he's sitting on the toilet with a stomach virus in Africa.
Wow.
So that's kind of a big come down from being the CEO of one of the top 10 companies in the world. I also think that sometimes you have examples like Andy Puzder, who was the CEO of a big fast food company. And he tries to join the Trump administration, but the confirmation process is so painful and it brings out all this ugly material from his divorce. He didn't do anything illegal, but some of it was unseemly, may or may not have been true. I mean, you know what divorce proceedings are like, but it was bad enough that he couldn't pursue being a CEO. So he got being a cabinet secretary at Labor. So he got embarrassed by having this information come out, but he also didn't get the job. So I would advise CEOs to be wary of going in.
What about, and I was curious about this aspect of it. You mentioned cabinet officials, CEOs having to get confirmed, of course. Congress and members of Congress and their view of the relationship between CEOs and presidents. Do we find, for example, people speaking out to presidents and saying, "Hey, don't get too cozy with CEOs like that. What are you doing?" Or do we have members of Congress saying, "Hey, that's terrific. I'm glad you're getting that kind of advice from them." Members of Congress, how do they fit into this dynamic?
Yeah, I think it's really based on their underlying ideological views of things. So obviously someone like Bernie Sanders would denounce the millionaires and billionaires who are talking to the president, whereas other, I guess, pro-innovation, pro-big business congressmen would say, "Yeah, that's great that you're talking to Elon Musk because he knows how to build efficiency." So I don't think there's one general rule. Obviously, there's 535 people in Congress, 100 senators, 435 House members, and they all have different views. So I don't think there's one way to typify how it is. But I think by looking to their ideological priors, you'd get a sense of how they're going to view these things.
It was striking to me in your book, really striking to me, that ideology seems to play less of a role than people might think in the relationship between CEOs and presidents. It's not so simple to say you have a left of center president and a right of center CEO, therefore they're not going to get along. It's a much more complicated story than just looking at things ideologically.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. But I think the reason is that if you look at these CEOs in general, not always, but in general, their top priorities are the interests of their company. And that's not necessarily an ideological thing. Now, there are some who get into it for ideological reasons. I mentioned Henry Luce earlier. I think Elon Musk, with his opposition to the woke mind virus, has an ideological predisposition that he's trying to pursue. But for the most part, if you're looking for the interests of your company, it's not necessarily going to be along an ideological spectrum. And I think that makes a difference. So look, I'm a historian. I look backwards, not forward.
But, give us a prediction. Help us think where this trend goes.
But I think if you just look at straight line extrapolation, it looks like it's going to get worse because CEOs and companies are getting more and more denounced by government and government officials and politicians in general. But my view of history is that it's not all straight line extrapolation. And so I think we're in a particularly bad moment for the relationship between CEOs, or at least we were until this recent election. And maybe with Ramaswamy and Musk coming in, the star power of someone like Musk, maybe they do some good on government efficiency. So maybe we start to turn things around. And it's important to remember, you're never going to have the Democrats lining up and saying, we love CEOs. Bill Clinton was somewhat friendly to business, and he had a business advisory council. But in general, the standard approach of Democrats these days is to denounce big business. But I think the problem for CEOs in recent years has been that both parties are going after them. And so maybe this starts to turn around with the CEO-Trump cooperation in this upcoming term.
I would be remiss if we let you go without, you mentioned already, some of the great jokes that are in the book. CEOs and presidents, while they share a kind of similar position, you call the loneliness of leadership, and they kind of get each other. On the other hand, there are moments where they just really don't get each other. They can't believe how the other guy thinks or talks. Give us some examples of that kind of funny, almost unbelieving relationship.
Yeah, look, I mean, they're just coming from different places. And so Lee Iacocca goes to see Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and he thinks that gas tax is the greatest thing now. Gas taxes do help car companies in some ways because the money goes to the highway trust fund, and so the better the highways, perhaps the better it is for car owners. Anyway, he's pushing Reagan to impose a gas tax. And Reagan's a free market anti-tax guy, and he says no, and he tells him, my pollster says that if I do a gas tax every time they fill up their cars, American people will say, oh, that's Ronald Reagan's fault that the gas prices are so high. And then the capper is, he says to Iacocca, and that's why I'm on this side of the desk and you're on that side. And I think that was going to be a pretty Iacocca display.
Right. Well, this, let me just again, to our listeners, highly recommend this really fascinating new book out by Tevi Troy. It's called, again, The Power and the Money, The Epic Clashes Between Commanders-in-Chief and Titans of Industry. You are going to love this. It's a great read, a great story that is being told, and I think an important story. Tevi, thanks again for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Great. Always happy to do The American Idea. Thanks for having me, and I'll let you know when my next book's coming.
Looking forward to it.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.